From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we'll learn about the lesser-known aspects of criminal sentencing, known as collateral consequences.
Then why poet, rapper, and activist Theo Wilson believes we need to step away from our computer keyboards to have conversations about race.
These are deep-seated, tribalistic, instinctual issues, and that if we have the courage to have these kind of conversations with folks in person, we may be able to get somewhere in terms of interpersonal racism and solving that problem.
And why the Pulitzer-winning author of The Underground Railroad refused to sanitize the brutal reality of American slavery.
Slaves were kept in chains. You know, they didn't use harsh language to keep millions of people in bondage. They raped, tortured, dehumanized millions of people to prevent them from running away and rising up.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Right now, there are more than 2 million people incarcerated in the United States, but that's just a small fraction of people with a criminal record.
More than 75 million people living in the United States have been convicted of some kind of crime, most of whom spend the majority of their lives in free society. But just because they serve their sentence, that doesn't mean they're free from the consequences associated with their convictions.
Jack Chin is the Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of Law at the University of California, Davis, and an expert on criminal law. He explains what collateral consequences are and how they impact people convicted of crimes.
Collateral consequences are the legal effects of a criminal conviction other than the traditional forms of punishment. So everybody's familiar, of course, with the fact that if you're convicted of a crime, you might have to go to jail, you might have to go to prison, you might have to pay a fine, you might have to be on probation or parole. But on top of that, there are a bunch of other things that can happen to you. You can lose the right to vote, you can lose the right to serve on a jury, you can be deported. And depending on the crime, you can lose lots of other rights and privileges, such as the ability to possess a firearm, the ability to drive a car. You can lose public benefits. And one of the most significant things that happens to a lot of people is that they lose their right, they lose their job, or they lose their right to have a license or a permit that they need to be employed or be in business.
So who is generally responsible for these consequences? Are they local? Are they statewide or federal?
All of the above. So some of the most important consequences are imposed by the federal government on state convictions. For example, the federal government passed a law some years ago that said that essentially all the states have to deprive people of driver's licenses if they've been convicted of a drug offense. And the federal government created an opportunity to opt out of that. But the federal government said, states, you have to do this or you're going to lose some federal funding. So that's one source. There's a number of collateral consequences imposed by the federal government. The federal government also makes it a crime to possess a firearm if you've been convicted of a federal or a state offense. The states also have a bunch of collateral consequences that they impose on their own, such as jury service and the right to vote, but also counties, cities, and agencies. So a lot of regulatory boards will say that you can't have a barber's license, you can't have a cosmetology license, you can't be an accountant. And these are not created by state law or federal law. They're created by an agency acting on its own. So they're really proliferating because so many levels of government and branches of government can create these collateral consequences.
So when people are convicted of a crime or when they're in a jury, are juries made aware of these consequences outside of the actual criminal conviction?
Generally, they're not. And for the most part, the Supreme Court and other courts have said that there is no duty on the part of either the judge or the defense attorney to advise the individual of the collateral consequences that might apply. Now, there is an exception. In 2010, in a case called Padilla versus Kentucky, the U.S. Supreme Court said that if the client in a criminal case is a non-citizen and they might be deported if they plead guilty or are convicted of the crime, then the defense attorney has to tell them that. But other things, for the most part, are, you know, some people call it the secret sentence or invisible punishment, because nobody has to tell the individual that this might happen. The jury doesn't necessarily know. The judge doesn't necessarily know. The lawyers don't necessarily know. And so these things a lot of times are surprises. To give you an example, in 2016, the Wisconsin Supreme Court said that there was no obligation to tell somebody pleading guilty or being convicted of a sex offense that after they serve whatever time is imposed, whatever prison time is imposed, they might be subject to civil commitment afterwards. This seems to be pretty important, right? If you're getting, let's imagine you're getting probation for a sex offense, the fact that you actually might be confined against your will, that would seem to be a pretty important consideration in deciding whether to go forward with that plea bargain or not, or how to handle that case. You know, do you mortgage your house to hire a lawyer or not? You know, how serious a problem is this? But the Supreme Court in this state said that it wasn't necessary for somebody to know that that was going to happen. So a lot of times people are surprised that they lose a vested public pension, for example, based on a particular criminal conviction, or they have to register as a sex offender or as some other sort of criminal offender.
Well, it seems problematic not just from the view of those who are convicted, but also of those who are convicting them, juries who don't really know what they're sentencing someone to. So when we look at Wisconsin specifically, what are some of the more kind of hidden sanctions that Wisconsin has?
Well, I will say that Wisconsin, of all the states, is one of the better states. And the reason for that is that your former public defender, Mike Tobin, his office put together some collections of major collateral consequences that apply based on convictions in this state. And so for the last 5 to 10 years, there has been better information available in Wisconsin than in most other states that defense lawyers can if they choose, or probation officers can if they choose, judges can if they choose, use to inform people of what the real situation is. But, you know, typically among the things that happens, ineligibility for public benefits is a significant one for drug offenses and other sorts of offenses. You might get kicked out of public housing. And a lot of times this applies not just if the leaseholder is convicted of a drug offense, but if anyone in the unit is convicted of a drug offense. So the whole family can lose their housing based on an offense by one member. And so that's pretty significant. The occupational disqualifications, many professions have a restriction on people with convictions, you know, holding a license as an attorney, as a doctor, that sort of thing. And in some instances, that will make perfect sense. In some instances, a criminal conviction really will be associated with a danger to customers, patients, clients, etc. But it's not clear to me why a conviction for income tax evasion, for example, means somebody can't go hunting. I don't see the connection. But the law says that if you have a felony conviction, then you can't possess a firearm, that sort of thing. The American Bar Association, pursuant to a contract from the federal government, put together a collection of collateral consequences in all the states. And it looks like there's something like 40, 50,000 collateral consequences in statutes and regulations. You know, so something like 800 to 1,000 in every state, mostly dealing with occupational disqualification, mostly dealing with jobs that a person can't have if they have a particular felony conviction.
In Wisconsin, we've had a little bit of pushback to some of these collateral consequences, specifically the occupancy rules on sex offenders. So I believe it was Pleasant Prairie where a group of sex offenders sued the city in order to have a little bit more leeway in where they were allowed to live.
Right.
And we're seeing that now throughout the state to the point that a lot of cities are trying to kind of preempt the lawsuit by removing some of these regulations. Are we seeing similar pushback to any other collateral consequences in Wisconsin or throughout the country?
I think there is a recognition that there are costs to imposing too many collateral consequences. We want to protect the public. We want to protect public safety. But we have tens of millions of people with criminal record out there. There's something like 2 million people in prison, but 75 million people, adult Americans, with a criminal record. And if they can't work, if they can't make a living in the legitimate economy, that's a big problem for us because many of them, if they can't make an honest living, will make a dishonest living. And there's a cost to society when somebody who could have been reformed, when somebody who could have contributed to society and lived a law-abiding life, instead recidivates and returns to crime. So one of the things that's happening in a lot of places around the country is something called ban the box. And ban the box means that in at least the initial application, in at least the initial part of a process for public employment or sometimes employment in general, the job application is not going to ask about criminal record unless there's an absolute bar. So let's say it's a law enforcement job and a felony conviction is an absolute bar. In that case, they might ask at the initial stage. But they'll wait until the person has a job offer. And at that point, they'll ask about the criminal record. And then in the context of the total person, in the context of all of the information that the employer has about the applicant whom they now want to hire, then they'll say, okay, does this criminal record change things? Or is it so far in the past and so contradicted by evidence of good behavior in the years since that criminal conviction that we're going to go ahead and hire this person? So that's something that's happened in a lot of cities and states around the country. And the view is that this gives people with criminal records a chance to make a living without unduly impairing public safety. Another thing that's happened is that there are a number of states in recent years have added methods to have a criminal record sealed, expunged, or overcome by a, let's say, a certificate of rehabilitation or a certificate of good conduct. And the idea is that once somebody has paid their debt to society and once somebody has demonstrated by good behavior over a period of years, there should be a way for the judge that sentenced them or for a parole board or somebody else to take a look at their record and say, we're ready to let you move on. If somebody has done what they're supposed to do, they've made a mistake in the past, you know, the evidence indicates that criminality, criminal behavior declines with age. And so older people are less likely to commit crimes than younger people. And so if we have somebody who looks like they're headed in the right direction, they might be able, there are more and more states that are allowing them to have their records sealed, expunged, or in some other way, some indication that they're no longer the person they were and they should be treated like everybody else in society.
All right. Well, Jack Chin, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Jack Chin is a law professor at the University of California, Davis, and he's the director of clinical legal education. This conversation originally aired in November while Chin was in Milwaukee for a lecture at Marquette University.
Up next, we meet poet and activist Theo Wilson, who shares what he learned by going undercover and impersonating a white supremacist online. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Thank you. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Theo Wilson wants us to have hard conversations about race, and he wants us to do it in person. Wilson might seem like an unlikely person to deliver that message. He's the winner of the 2007 Erotic Poetry Slam.
But the African-American poet and rapper is perhaps more famous for his stint as Lucius 25, a white supremacist online troll. The experience opened his eyes to the humanity of people whose views he profoundly disagrees with.
Wilson's TEDx talk about the experience and the lessons he draws from it have had 1.6 million views online, and it's what brought him to Carroll University last month. He stopped by our studio then as well. Theo Wilson, it is such a pleasure and an honor to meet you. Thanks so much for coming over this morning.
Thank you for having me.
I loved your TED Talk, and I wanted to start with the idea of conversation and how conversation for you is the key to making things better. It sometimes seems to me that conversation is what gets us in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, listen, I want to be clear on something about conversation. There are multiple levels to the beast that we deal with when it comes to racism. However, conversation can attack one of them very well, and that's interpersonal racism. Not so much institutionalized, but interpersonal. What you have is the ability to humanize yourself and make it clear and abundantly, at least a visual, that you are somebody who has the same concerns as somebody across the aisle from you. And that if you do it right, you find out that there's a lot more in common than there are that separate folks. And so I think that's what I meant by conversations being the key to at least building bridges.
So the idea that sitting down with somebody that you fundamentally disagree with in a lot of cases, how do you get past the things that you disagree with that person?
Well, you know, one of the things that I said in the TED Talk is we're talking about face-to-face conversations as opposed to online conversations. And that is because the cage effect, you can see this in road rage, anger management, right? When you're in what you feel is a contained environment, certain parts of the aggressive side of your personality become amplified. Well, the same thing happens over the internet. But once you're face to face with somebody and you see like them living and breathing in front of you, you're number one faced with the immediate threat of the person right there. Is something that kind of puts some people who are of a hateful mindset on their heels. And they have to reckon with the fact that this is a person who is a human being versus the internet. Because there's no immediate consequence for you saying something hateful. There's no immediate threat if you should traverse somebody's personal boundaries. These are deep-seated, tribalistic, instinctual issues. And that if we have the courage to have these kind of conversations with folks in person, we may be able to get somewhere in terms of interpersonal racism and solving that problem.
I was going to say, what you're talking about sounds an awful lot like what people used to call civilization,
you know,
like putting aside that tribalistic, very me-centered way of being in the world and thinking about somebody else.
Absolutely. Well, the problem is that the way race is set up in the country is a zero-sum game. It's always, if this person gains, I have to lose, and vice versa. I understand the zero-sum game when it was originated. But right now, we literally have technologically out-evolved all zero-sum games. And it's funny because a lot of the technology came from war, came from setting up a victory for zero-sum games, meaning there's got to be positive sum here. There's got to be a way that we all can win. And the things that cause structural racism in this country, the things that have been studied in terms of housing discrimination and the economic consequences of that, they drag the nation down competitively against other Western nations who don't have these kind of issues. So if an African-American is in poverty because of generational deprivation, that's still an American that's in poverty. And that counts when it comes to our rating against other countries and what they have in terms of their markers of civilization. So if we can actually get past this, everyone benefits. And it's time that we started to have that conversation so it can transverse into other areas.
When you went underground and became a white supremacist troll is pretty much what you did.
Yeah.
What surprised you the most about doing that? Because you basically walked the walk about what you're just saying about we have to have these conversations. You started by doing the trolling thing, but then kind of discovered some stuff about yourself.
Yeah, what I realized was that the folks who are in the alt-right and generally are ultimately the victims of an educational system. And so I don't want to take them off the hook in terms of their own bigotry. Let's be clear on that. What I found was that this is the inevitable outcome of when you don't teach history the right way. There are things that you miss, and that when you have a set of rules like political correctness, a few generations down the line, the conditions that made the rules necessary begin to evaporate. So naturally, people begin to question the rules in and of themselves. What folks don't realize is that when you remove these barriers of saying words that harm people, when you remove the barriers that stop people from denigrating someone's humanity, the conditions that originated the rules arise again. And so when you attack that and you don't know the history behind that, that's something that is obviously destructive, and we have to figure out how to recontextualize our relationships in terms of the history that we're actually not that far removed from.
No, because we're not.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure when you were born. I grew up in the 60s.
Born in the 80s, yeah.
Okay, I was born in the late 50s and grew up in the 60s and 70s. Civil rights movement, women's rights movement, those early days of those things, and seeing major changes happen, and then, of course, the backlash.
And the backlash. And that's kind of historically the cycle with America. The old folks say, and I don't want to be too crass here, but the old black folks say, the white man giveth and the white man taketh away. It's, you know, you can see the cycle happening after the Emancipation Proclamation. There was an era during the Reconstruction period up until 1877 where there were great advancements in black life, including the first black lieutenant governor ever elected in the state of Louisiana, Oscar Dunn. So that, I mean, you would never think that that would happen before 1900, and yet still it did. And then the betrayal of 1877 with the election of Rutherford B. Hayes brought in the Jim Crow era. People think Jim Crow started right after slavery. That's not true. There was this gap. And then so you have then the advancements made from the Civil Rights Movement. And right after that, you have the expansion of the prison industrial complex, the new Jim Crow, the laws that criminalize basically survival behavior. So then that incarcerates so many African Americans, and we're still dealing with the fallout from that right now.
In this state, very, very much so.
I bet. I would love to hear more of that.
The highest rate of black male incarceration in the nation.
Wow.
In this state.
See what I'm saying? So, you know, and then you have, you know, in this era, following the first black president, you have this, what Van Jones called a white lash, those who felt oppressed somehow underneath Barack Obama. Now having, quote unquote, their say in the era that we see now. So, this is a cyclical thing. And once history is discovered like that, black folks have some interesting choices ahead of us in terms of how to deal with this cycle and getting out, because this cycle takes our lives, you know.
Well, what about white people
like
me?
Mm-hmm.
How do you suggest that, particularly the people on the alt-right, who have absorbed these ideas that are not constructive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, conversations are wonderful, but what's the next step? How do you take it so that it becomes policy, it becomes civilization?
Well, I mean, you know, reality asserts itself. If you have an erroneous idea in your head about race and the value of human life, eventually, that will come to be corrected. What needs to be done, I think a lot of stuff is already becoming at least apparent in terms of action steps. The fact that, like, for example, after Charlottesville, there was great pressure in the country to classify white extremist groups as terrorists and to treat them as such. You know what I mean? That political will ain't going anywhere. That's on its way. What's being titled the Blue Wave this November's election season, if Alabama was any indicator on what the electorate is going to do, then, you know, we have a possible new wave of policymakers that will institute policy changes that will make certain punitive actions against those who are domestic terrorists, like folks who act in white supremacist ideology, make those measures stick. And so I think that's a good thing. But also in terms of the alt-right, I think a lot of them are starting to realize, you know, especially after Charlottesville, you guys are on the wrong end of history again. That's a tragedy. There's so much history to learn. This is the age of Google. You can find out anything you need to know. And if you don't take the steps to have some accountability in this, then you'll end up a hate criminal, and that will stick with you forever. You know what I mean?
But going back to what you've talked about a number of times about the echo chamber, you know, how do you get people out of their, whatever their echo chamber is, whether it's a very conservative one, a very liberal one, where you think you're being open and progressive, but you're not necessarily?
Yeah.
How do you get people outside of that echo chamber?
Well, the first step was to acknowledge that it exists. And I think one of the great things about my TED Talk is it seemed, and I don't know if I was in my own echo chamber with this, but it seemed like after the TED Talk hit, a lot more conversation around what echo chambers are and their consequences began to take place in the country. And once you realize that you're in a liberal echo chamber, then you have to figure out, okay, these folks who are conservatives are your neighbors. They're people that your children may date one day. You know what I mean? If you stop at condemnation, then what do you truly gain with that? You see what I'm saying? The issue is that the way the tribalization is with the country right now, I've seen the left be more honest and accountable with holding their standard bearers accountable than I've seen the right as of late. There's this fear, it seems, on the right to be intellectually honest about like the consequences of the Trump administration. Be honest about what it means that he can't keep any staff, including recently with the firing of Rex Tillerson. Like what it means that there seems to be a blame game going on that wants to indict everybody but the person in charge and the people who put them there. And so that's going to have a cost. If you don't break out of your echo chamber, then the consequences when they hit will be that much more severe.
Severe for everyone.
For everyone.
Because we're talking about the structure of the country.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I have to say, you know, that's terrifying.
It is. And I have cousins, you know, who are black conservatives. You know what I mean? Like black conservative people who are married also to white conservative people. And a lot of conservative people are concerned about the actions of our supposedly conservative president, who was a limousine liberal up until 5 years ago. And what we find is that he has gotten to the point where he's learned a dangerous trick that he can get to the top of the news cycle if he dismantles the country from within. And that is dangerous because we've got too many enemies out here who are looking for a weakened state. And regardless of where you fall in terms of the spectrum of patriotism, we're all connected to this thing. And so we as a nation have to figure out the political atmosphere that got us in this kind of danger and make sure that we never cross that threshold again and figure out ways to work together across partisan lines. And I hope that that's what my talk can at least inspire people to do.
Well, also the other thing you do is poetry slam. And poetry is another very immediate way to talk to people. And that's one of the reasons you're here in Wisconsin as well, is to, you're holding a poetry slam, aren't you?
I'm teaching kind of a workshop on how I did what I did. So the thing that got me on the TED stage was that they invited me in to be kind of a palate cleanser of a poet. And my poems were just terribly popular at those TEDx Mile Highs. But spoken word, you know, I started off as a rapper anyway. So rap is just rhythmic, aggressive poetry. I began to take my raps to poetry competitions and win them. And over time, I evolved into an actual slam poet and won the National Poetry Slam about 6 or 7 years ago. And so that opened up gates. And so it's just kind of this thing, this evolution from rapper to poet to speaker and performer.
Do you think that poetry as an art form is a way that we can talk to each other listen to each other?
Poetry's super immediate. Like when if you got a poetry venue, you know, you can have, you know, 200 to 300 people there sometime every week, you know. And with that, you have the chance to literally, if it's an open mic, you can write something and get your message out to 200 to 300 people like that. You know what I mean? Those people are all voters. Those people all hold sway in certain industries sometimes. You never know who's in the audience. And so, yeah, I have seen poetry change public opinion. And I think that it's a very, very powerful means, especially when you got a sitting audience and a culture that's already open to it.
Yeah, I think art always, in its best sense, speaks truth to power.
It does.
Always.
Yeah, and historically speaking, it's been the poets that have been the canaries in the mineshaft when social change is about to happen. You know, out-and-out revolutions have been kind of captured by poets in their art, you know, since time immemorial. So, yeah, poetry is one of those things. It distills language, which distills thought, which distills a zeitgeist if you do it right.
Do you consider yourself a canary in the coal mine?
I don't think I couldn't be. There's no way that I wouldn't be in terms of what's happening in our culture right now. I'm very grateful to have been allowed access to certain platforms to share what I know, because I think that when change comes, there's always a warning. And if it's going to be a negative change, then there's a warning before destruction. And hopefully I can aid in that. You can only shine the light. If folks choose to turn away, that's on them. But I'm here to shine whatever light that I have.
Well, Theo Wilson, we are so happy you are here to shine that light.
Thank you so much for having me.
Theo Wilson is a poet, rapper, and social activist. He spoke about his experience impersonating an online white supremacist troll at an event at Carroll University in March. There's a link to his TEDx talk about his experience at WUWM.com.
Coming up after a break, we'll talk with Colson Whitehead, who won a National Book Award and a Pulitzer Prize for his novel, The Underground Railroad. We'll find out why it was the book that scared him most to write when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Colson Whitehead has won just about every literary accolade there is for the Underground Railroad. The Pulitzer Prize, the Carnegie Medal, and the National Book Award are but three. The book is also a New York Times bestseller, and it's been translated into 40 languages.
The novel tells the story of Cora, a slave on a Georgia cotton plantation somewhere in the 1850s, and her desperate attempt to escape to freedom. It pulls no punches about the brutal reality of slavery in the antebellum South, nor does it sugarcoat the less obvious but equally repellent bigotry of the North. Yet despite the subject matter, the book is hopeful, and the character of Cora is utterly compelling.
Colson Whitehead has said The Underground Railroad was the book that scared him to write. So when I reached him by phone, I wanted to know why.
I first had the idea way back in the spring of the year 2000, and I was finishing up a novel and came across a reference to the Underground Railroad. And thought, oh, you know, what kind of weird story could I generate if I made this metaphor into a literal train? And it just seemed, you know, I was 30 years old. I was hanging out till like 4 a.m. most nights. And it seemed I wasn't a good enough writer, I think, to pull it off. I just felt I didn't have the kind of chops in terms of technique to pull off a story with its sort of structural gambits. And I think I was mature enough to write a book about slavery at that age. And deal with the subject in the way it deserved to be treated. As the years went on, you know, I'd finish a book and think, am I ready? And the answer was always no. And then, you know, at a certain point, it just seemed I'd been putting it off for so long that I had to address why I was putting it off and sort of face the book I was avoiding.
There are such huge themes here. Obviously, slavery and the fact that this brutality, that this crack in the foundation of this country is kind of what founded it. And I found as I was reading it that I felt very complicit in that, in somehow not acknowledging, even though I know it's happened, but somehow not owning it. And I found the book made me live it in a way that as a white person, I don't live it.
Well, I mean, I think think everyone sort of relates to the story of slavery in different ways. You know, I think that it's not really taught very deeply in elementary school or high school. At least that was my experience. And from traveling is what I get from people who come out to hear me read. And so we'd rather talk about Abraham Lincoln and not slavery. We'd rather talk about Martin Luther King and not segregation. And so when, you know, I think when a book like this comes along, and it is very, I think, vivid in how it describes the violence of how slaves were kept in chains. You know, they didn't use harsh language to keep millions of people in bondage. They raped, tortured, dehumanized millions of people to prevent them from running away and rising up. And it was obviously incredibly brutal. And so if you haven't contemplated or confronted the material facts of slavery in a while, the book is surprising. And I'm not sure about complicity, but if you're descended from slave owners, you know, you have to reckon with the fact that the family farm was paid for by the blood of enslaved peoples, and that, you know, the portrait of your great 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 grandpa or grandma, who was so beloved, was not necessarily a nice person.
Did you find that it was difficult for yourself, as you were researching this and writing this, to actually look at the brutality of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like a lot of kids, my introduction to slavery was Roots when I was like 8 years old. And then, of course, I studied history in college. But, you know, but coming to the material and diving so deeply in as a grown-up, I have kids. And then you understand, you know, with a more adult understanding, the real seriousness of the situation, the terrible devastation, what it'd be like to see your child beaten, sold off, vice versa. And then, you know, I came into the book. I was not writing. I was outlining and coming up with the characters. And I realized just how much I'd have to put Cora through just to be realistic, and the supporting cast, how much brutality. And then, and also just the fact that it's a miracle I'm here. You know, at any point, my ancestors could have died in this or that moment, in the middle of passage, on the plantation. And it's just luck that, you know, they lived to have children, and their children had children.
I think about Cora, she's such a powerful character, and she was somebody that was obviously shaped by everything that she went through, but somehow manages to transcend as well, even when she, you know, she sort of realizes at times that she thinks she's free and she's not. And her journey is such an important one.
Well, I mean, you know, we're talking about people today contemplating what happened 200 years ago, 150 years ago. You know, part of writing the book is trying to figure out what kind of personality would survive slavery, be able to have the capacity for hope that there's a place of refuge in the North, and then have the courage to flee the plantation. And, you know, we're getting our food at Whole Foods and having our nice 21st century lives. How do we contemplate, you know, the kind of personality that can do what Cora takes on in the book? And so part of the undertaking is figuring out a character who can survive and also be hopeful in a way that's very unlikely for someone in her circumstance.
Yes, the book does end on a hopeful note. And I found that it was almost a balm at the end of, you know, everything that the characters have gone through, and all of the setbacks and all of the difficulties, just the horrors that they've survived, that you leave us with just a little bit. You know, that there's this possibility that something good could happen.
And that's the hope that sort of, you know, keeps her going through the book, the improbable idea that there's a place of safety and refuge. And, you know, and strangely, my book before this was about, novel before this was about a zombie apocalypse and one of the survivors trying to find the last human settlement. And so they're both very different. One is a post-apocalyptic horror novel, and then there's this one. But they're both, you know, strangely animated by this hope that there's a place you can go and be whole and safe in the devastation.
Do you find that as you've been going around the country reading and getting reactions from people who've read the book and have come to the readings, do you get a racial divide in the reactions?
Well, it sort of depends. I mean, I think in the South, you know, I wasn't sure how the South would respond. I'd never been invited to read that extensively in the South. And it's really been embraced in certain places like North Carolina and Georgia. I've gone to like North Carolina 6 times for college visits or libraries or bookstores since the book has come out. Then I haven't been to Alabama. So what does that mean? You know, is there a new South that is ready to reconcile and sort of contemplate its history? And are there sections that are not so up to the task? I mean, I think in terms of reaction, I found it really interesting in Europe. You know, it's been much more successful than my previous books in different countries. And those two things. One is that, say, in France or Poland, where there was a French resistance against the Nazis, they connected their resistance to the Underground Railroad workers, you know, people getting folks to safety, subverting this oppressive regime. And so even though it is about American slavery in a very specific sort of way, it is open to a lot of different countries' interpretation in terms of, say, World War II, but also just that dynamic between the oppressors and the oppressed, whether you see it as royalty versus peasants, slave masters versus slaves, the rich against, you know, serfs, royalty against serfs. And so that power dynamic has translated in a way that I didn't expect when I was writing it.
Well, and of course, we're kind of talking around the construct that you have here of the literal Underground Railroad, that in this world, the Underground Railroad that we learned about in school is actually made manifest. There are stops and tracks and trains, and they literally run underneath, you know, they're in the substructure of the country. And I love that touch of magic realism.
I mean, you know, the book comes out of that proposition of making the Underground Railroad into a literal train. And so from its very conception, it's a fantastic book. And once Cora does escape the plantation and goes on her first train ride, we enter into an alternative America, and each state that she goes through, whether it's South Carolina, North Carolina, has its own different sort of alternative America that it's presenting. And it enables, you know, the book to do what it does, I think, in a sort of compelling way, which is not tell what actually happened, but propose an alternative history, an alternative conversation about how the country came to be.
I was also struck as she was stopping off in different places. She was in South Carolina first, then North Carolina, then Indiana, and then going west, that it felt almost Homerian, you know, that you were having Odysseus trying to return home, in this case, Cora trying to find home, trying to find safety, and being seduced along the way by things that looked good but ended up not being.
Sure. I mean, you know, I guess when I had the book in the back of my head for many years, I would tell my friends what was it about and the structure, and they'd say, oh, that sounds really stupid, Coulson. And then I start saying Gulliver's Travels, and they're like, oh, so it's a different island. Each state's like a different island. But that structure, you know, does go back to the Odyssey, you know, where a hero is tested in a series of allegorical adventures, and you sort of solve one problem, confront one problem, go on to the next chapter, and there's a whole new sort of system. And that's definitely what confronts Cora, you know, the sort of ancient structure of storytelling. She figures out what's great about South Carolina, what's wrong, and then goes to the next adventure.
And sort of escapes. I mean, in each case, she escapes those particular bonds. How has it felt? I mean, you won all kinds of accolades for this. You've gotten the Pulitzer, the National Book Award. How does it affect the writing you're doing now?
Sure. I mean, it's always pretty hard. So it's not as if, you know, obviously the book is very successful. Does it make the next one easier? No, you know, it's all, you know, pretty difficult work. Do I feel pressure from other people's expectations?
Or your own expectations?
Yeah, I mean, I'm already pretty tough on myself. I'll have to amp it up, you know, for the next one. And so whether, you know, it was 8 books ago when I was broke and didn't know if I could write, or now, and I have to, you know, come up with an idea, a compelling story after gaining a you know, much bigger readership. There's always some sort of weird problem that is bugging you. And so if it's not this, it's that. So, you know, again, you know, 8 books in, I never sort of thought I'd have a book that took off like this. And it's very surprising and unlikely and very lovely. And it's hard to be in my usual depressive mood, I'm sad to say.
You have to find your way back to
that.
Yeah, for the next book. Do you ever envision at this point revisiting Cora or picking up her story? Or is this sort of a complete tale in and of itself?
It's pretty much done for me. I can't think of what else I have to say about her or what else there is to add to her journey. You know, I always do a lot of outlining before I start, and I have to know the destination before I start writing. And so where she ends up is where I wanted to put her, you know, for so many years. And maybe I didn't know if it was Missouri or Canada or New York or Massachusetts, but that sort of emotional place that we leave her at is what made the most sense to me and what I was writing to the whole time.
Yeah, it feels, as a reader, I have to say, it feels very complete. You know, I kind of know on some level what happens to her after the last page of the book. I kind of know somehow, you know, things will be okay in some form. Finding, as we've talked about earlier, you know, finding that hope in all of that despair.
Well, you know, she's off the plantation. Where she actually ends up, you know, is unclear finally at the end. But even if she goes to, say, San Francisco, and it's a great city, she finds someone to love, and she wins a lottery, and is like a multimillionaire, she's still a black woman in 1850s America, which is a very racist place. And so, you know, there are gradations of freedom available to all of us, not just Cora. And, you know, no matter where she ends up, there's still a reality of the country and the time that she's living in.
Do you feel that we are in a place now that too closely harkens back to what was going on? I mean, we don't have literal slavery anymore, but we have some pretty ugly racist things going on.
No, yeah. I mean, we have a white supremacist president who's embracing all the sort of worst impulses and sort of terrible energies that have caused so much sort of pain over the centuries. And so I think we are in a sort of terrible place, in a very precarious place. We have to hope that we pull out of it. But it is, you know, it's hard to open the news every day and sort of see how the latest permutation of the daily horror that you have to confront when you get up every morning.
Do you think that the United States will ever heal? I mean, again, we were founded on genocide and slavery. And it seems like a very big, big wound to heal.
I'm not sure about healing, but I think if we can learn, I think if we actually teach slavery, if we teach the dispossession of Native Americans properly and deeply and thoroughly in school, and I think we sort of curb our sort of worst impulses, we get further away, and maybe that's healing. But I think if we, instead of, you know, sort of running away and avoiding all these different episodes in our history and you know, and taught them to, you know, to the children, I think we move on, if not heal. I mean, I've met people who, in the last year and a half, who still thought the Underground Railroad was a train. Like, when we're kids, we think that, you know, and then we hopefully a teacher tells us how it actually worked. But there are people who are like, oh, actually, I thought it was a real train all these years, and people in the 30s and 40s. And so I think that says that we have a long way to go before we're actually teaching our history in a proper way.
Colson Whitehead is the author of the prize-winning and best-selling novel, The Underground Railroad. Our interview with him first aired in January.
We have time for some music to end the show today. Milwaukee singer-songwriter Kaylee Conway joined us earlier this year for an in-studio performance. Here she is with her song, As Long as It's a Secret.
Well, as long as it's a secret, as long as it's a secret, what I let slip. Well, as long as it's a secret, as long as it's a secret. Sudden for some reason quit. Waiting around for me, out of ideas and idly. Everywhere I go, I'll fault him for follow. Everywhere I go, I'll fault him for follow. Everywhere I go, I will bring him for belong. Everywhere I go, I will bring him for belong. Well, as long as it's a secret, as long as it's a secret. Sudden for some reason quit.
Milwaukee singer-songwriter Kaylee Conway playing As Long As It's a Secret in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. She'll be performing at the Back Room at Colectivo this Friday, opening for Field Report for their album release show. To hear Conway's full interview with me and artist Marielle Alschwang, head to WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock and fresh air is next.